Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And how did we end up in February already, Rabbit?
It's amazing. I don't know how we did it, but
we did.
Yeah, we did. We did, and we're actually later in the program. We're actually looking back to an adventure we had in December, but we had a couple of adventures also across the Big Pond, as we call the Atlantic Ocean. In more recent interviewing activity, and first up, a chef who claims, however you describe it, to have written 22 books.
Yeah, that's a lot of books.
And took us until number 22 to catch up with him, possibly because he was also cooking at a wonderful London hotel called the Lanesborough at the same time as he was writing all these books.
Yeah.
And he's been there for 22 years. And is now off doing some adventuring. But in the meantime, he took time out to write a book, a definitive book, one might add, about a four-letter word in food, which is?
Soup.
S-O-U-P.
It'll be our second great soup book of the season, by the way.
So here's all about super soups from Paul Gaylor. We're talking to London today, and we're talking specifically to chef Paul Gaylor, who just produced the definitive book about a four-letter word, soup. And I searched through it from cover to cover, and I could not find a recipe for brown Windsor. why is that so, do you think?
We don't do brown Windsor anymore, Peter.
Oh, we don't?
It's just one of the great. You've got the nearest one, but that would be the classic oxtail soup, which goes with Guinness. Again, a good old British Isles ingredient.
But I like brown Windsor, because the thing brown Windsor reminds you of the most is the color of the dishwater when you're done with all the dishes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
in many people's renditions, it tastes just about as appetizing.
But who's making it, Peter?
but you started out on a mammoth project and then made it even more complicated. So tell us your starting point and then how it sort of morphed into the book that landed on our table.
Why did you pick soups?
Well, this is my 22nd book, Anne. This is my 22nd book on different varying subjects, which are beautifully, you know, all over America. Burgers, there's passion for cheese, burgers, potato books. So if your listeners are looking up Paul Gaylor, they'll find more than one book, but hopefully it's nice to hear that the soup book has made America. No, I mean, my interest in soup, my publisher said to me, Paul, you know, we still get people asking for some nice soups, you know, what's your favourite soups? And I thought, hey, this is a great idea to start my own cook's collection of soups, you know, going back as a young chef, and I've been in the business 40 years now. I can go back to the years ago when I first started in the kitchens of the Royal Garden Hotel in London, to the big, you know, 50-gallon soup pots boiling away, learning how to make a velouté soup, a cream soup, and then moving on to things like the more refined consommés. So it's a great base for any cook to learn. So that's really, you know, it was the case of the publisher saying, you know, Paul, let's go with a soup book. And I thought, soup book, you know, how many soup books are there out there? But I think at the end of the day, with all these sort of years of experience I've had, I've moved them around, done different styles, you know, whether they're natural broths, or creamy, hearty, wholesome, and against the traditional flavors, as Peter mentioned, the brown Windsors may be giving way for a London particular, which is a ham soup with celery leaves.
I saw that in the book, yes.
Now, the most amazing thing that struck me as I read through the book is the vibrancy of the colors, though, of the soups that you have in here. You have wonderful...
Well, I think any food, Peter, starts with, you know, although the flavor's got to be 100%, at the end of the day, we eat with our eyes, and that's the thing which have always stuck with me, even as a young chef. At the end of the day, food's got to look appetizing. If it's not looking appetizing, you're immediately thinking, well, that doesn't look too good, I don't fancy eating that. But if you know, soups are like anything else. Food needs to be colorful, it needs to be appetizing, it needs to be interesting, that makes people want, hey, I want to cook this book. So, you know, so it's important that, you know, with all the variety of the soups we've got, from vegetables to meats to fish, we've got great colors there, so there's no excuse for not making it something special.
You have Jerusalem artichoke soup here, and most of those soups, because we grow Jerusalem artichokes, are always sort of dull brown, but you have flower petals and so forth strewn about.
Oh, yeah. Well, again, we're getting quite trendy now in England now. We're getting back onto the years ago, there was a little movement towards doing some different flowers in salads and things, and that seemed to went. But now the sort of modern day chefs in London and all over the world, I think, are now starting to, you know, get back. And as I said before, making garnishings a little bit more exciting. You know, it doesn't have to be a swirl of cream or a few croutons on top. Let's make soup interesting. And people say, when it comes to the table, say, wow, look at that.
This looks
again, they've got flavor, so it adds to what makes it nice.
This one looks a little like you tore up butterfly wings, though. I'm sorry.
Maybe you did.
I've looked at it over and over again, and I always see torn up butterfly wings. But you have all kinds of accompaniments as well. I was intrigued by your anchovy beignets. You dreamed those up.
Yeah, that's great. With the broccoli soup, yeah, it's lovely. Again, you've got those white boucherons, which are white anchovies. They're down on the top, you know, giving you textures. Again, soup is not just to be about, obviously it's a liquid base, but you've got those other things that are going to make them a little bit crunchy, like the beignets, so you've got a little bit of crunch. You've got some scones, which you can obviously, with some more classical cheese straws, different gougères, even some nice little pita crisps and that sort of thing, yeah. At the end of the day, obviously food, again, needs to be a mixture of textures. It shouldn't be all one particular liquid. So by adding different garnishes, like crispy fried garnishes, different oils, even citrus powder, which is, again, the orange powder within the soup, again, with a vichyssoise, just gives that a little bit of vibrancy right at the end down to give a little, you know, you've got that carrot flavour. There's a little bit of orange hits the back of the palate, which is nice, you know. So, mixing things around and making things interesting that people want to be able to cook them.
You sort of lead in, though, with all these Asian soups. Why that?
Well, I actually worked out in Singapore for a while during my training, and again, I love my own thing. I consider myself a bit of a culinary nomad. I love to different tastes. I travel around the world doing promotions, doing different cooking, picking up, as we all do as chefs and cooks. You know, I'm sure you come down to good old Cornwall and find out that you've got a great stargazy pie down there, and you're going to bring it back to America and cook it. And so at the end of the day, you take all these different ideas, you bring them back, and I love the sort of the soups, the Tom Yum Goong and all those sort of soups from Asia. To me, I could live on Asian food rather than British, if I'm truthful, but I hope no one from England has listened to this.
Yeah. I'm sorry, your secret's out, Paul. You're in trouble now. Everybody knows. you'll have to do your next book about Asian food.
Well, next book's on poultry, so with a lot of my books, they are very contemporary. They are using flavors from around the world. Now, I mean, we travel so much more now, Peter. We years ago, we didn't travel as much. Now, travel is within the grasp. You know, most people now can afford to do a little bit of traveling, so they go and try new experiences. That normally includes new different types of food. And you come back, and you're not surprised when you come back to America or to London and say, oh, I tasted that in New York, or I tasted that in Japan, or I tasted that. And so, again, these sort of places, people are looking for these flavors throughout the books. You know, the days have gone of the brown Windsor and the London, particularly on their own, and the cream of Jerusalem. You know, we're going to be giving some different ideas, and the soup lends itself to doing different styles. And say the Asian is just part of one of them, you know.
Yeah, I like this mussel soup with Thai gremolata.
Let me tell you.
You're making me hungry, Anne. I don't know what time it is. I think it's the afternoon where you are, but in the evening I'm ready for dinner.
What kind of soup are you having for dinner tonight?
Well, my wife's cooking this evening. As I say, I'm just at the moment finishing off a bit towards a new book I'm writing, as I said, on poultry. So my time's right. We start actually shooting next week. So I'm just getting all the bits and pieces and props ready for photography for join the photographer next week. So my wife's cooking. I think she may even be doing something a little bit Asian herself tonight, a little stir-fried chicken. But, you know, my wife's quite a good cook, so I'll leave it in her capable hands.
That's good.
Let me tell you a funny story. This just happened. This was December 23, and my brother moved house 4 days before we arrived in December. So I wrote to him and I said, you remember last year we got those wonderful fish cakes at the Kingsley Village shopping market? I said, why don't I get those to bring those down, because he won't want to be cooking now. This turned out to be entirely untrue, because he cooked great meals every single day. But there was no fish. There were no fish cakes, because there was no fish, because nobody had been out in the sea, because it was all so rough.
As you know, Peter, you're just coming back here. The weather has been very bad here in London. We're all over the country. We've had major upheavals on the coast with, you know, some people have been drowned, or we've been with water and everything. So it's not been great. We're experiencing these a lot more now than we did since the last 10 years or so. So a little bit concerning. They say there's nothing to do with the weather patterns, but it's getting a bit worrying. A lot of places are getting flooded throughout England now. And this has not been a great winter for us here.
Well, no,
we're going to have a better summer for next year.
You missed the rest. You missed the rest of the story, though. The rest of the story. We're now stuck with. We're supposed to buy something for dinner. We have the responsibility of getting something for dinner, and the butcher was almost sold out. But he said, "Well, I do have these chickens, and they're 2 for £10, which can't be bad." So I called my brother on the phone. I said, can you cook two small chickens? He said, sure, I can do that. So we turned back to the guy and we said, well, are these free-range chickens? And he said, well, not exactly.
not for £5, no.
No, he said, they scratch around during the day, but we lock them up at night. Well, these tasted like 20-pound chickens. They were really excellent. There was some left over and to have for breakfast the next day. So I thought maybe you might want to include a section in your book on not quite free range chickens and what to do with them. But back to soup.
Yeah, now I want to point out that you have most of the classics in here. You can go from your classic, but then there are exotic things such as, I'm looking at Al Harira with date pastas.
Oh, Harira. Now, Harira is a Moroccan speciality, Anne, which is fantastic.
Yeah, with date pastas.
I did my first Harira about 10 years ago in the capital, can't remember the name of it. And, basically that was fantastic.
And you have chickpeas
it's a lovely,
in it?
It's a lovely soup. Again, lots of flavors in there. Nice and hearty.
I think I'd like to make that.
Now, the other thing you did we haven't mentioned yet is you managed to persuade some of your friends to give you soup recipes as well. Tell us about some of those
friends. Throughout the years, I've used a lot of friends. A good friend of mine said the sad loss of Charlie Trotter.
Oh,
great loss to the culinary world, even here in England.
But you know Danielle, huh?
Danielle was in the new book. Danielle's in the new book. Susan Spicer.
You know he got
married. Very good friend
married.
Of mine down in Bayona, New Orleans.
You know Danielle got married, huh?
Again.
Did you know that?
I didn't know that. When did he get married again?
Was it August? Just
a few months ago.
Last time I saw Danielle actually was when he over a year ago when he came to London and he invited me over and I couldn't make it. So it's a shame. So I didn't know that, but I'm like him. I'm always on the run somewhere. But that's wish him congratulations. That sounds great.
Right. And who else do you have in here? You had.
Well, he has a famous Pierre
Cotton. We've got a mix of chefs. I don't know if you know Carluccio, obviously Antonio Carluccio, very well-known Italian chef, real character, great friend. And then we've got some of the younger constituents like Chris and Jeff Galvin. Galvin brothers now have got a sort of a fairly big restaurant operation now in London. They've got three restaurants. They're also up in Scotland. Chris worked with me at Inigo Jones restaurant back in Covent Garden back in the 80s. And he's gone on to, he opened the Lanesborough with me. That's my executive sous chef there. And then he's gone on to do great things with his brother Jeff, who worked with Shane, with Nico Ledenis. They're two great boys doing a great job. Which is a very well-known, larger-than-life character over here. Kaufman, you may have heard of Pierre Kaufman. So,
I think we have.
Have indeed, yeah.
Pierre is up the road from me when I was at the Lanesborough. He's in the, he's about 500 yards, so he's a good man for a cup of coffee. And a good chef. Atul Kochar, great Indian chef. So, yeah, these are all friends, which basically, you know, I just wanted to say, hey, come on, give us some of your favorite cook's collection recipes, and they've done that, which is fantastic of them, really. Very pleased.
Well, this is an exciting book, and you're at an exciting point in your career. My suggestion, would you please go to Cornwall and open a decent restaurant down there?
Maybe Peter's brother there. Maybe you should come back, leave New York, come to our beautiful country, Peter, and come and live down in Cornwall. No better than live in Cornwall. If the sun's shining, there's no other better place in England.
Well, now, hold on just a second. We did go to, last year, we went to Jamie Oliver's 15 Cornwall.
That was good.
At Watergate Bay.
And that was, and that was extremely good.
We used to have, my family and I used to have, we used to take my youngest daughter, who's now 21, but when she was a little bit younger, she used to surfboard, they're not me, she used to surfboard, so while she was out surfboarding, I was normally enjoying Jamie's 15 lunch and dinner and breakfast, so,
yeah. Great.
So that was quite good.
Well, you must tell us what new adventures you're up to
when
you figure out what they are.
So looking at some new opportunities at the moment, Peter, just going to say at the moment, getting on with the book, possibly consulting on a new restaurant opening in London, but then I shall knuckle down and find something which is, you know, at the moment, I've had 22 years of great times at the Lanes Brass, but I love, you know, it's got a great, thankfully it's had a great reputation over these years. Time for me to move on and looking forward to the new challenge. But, you know, if we're ever in London, I'd love to meet up and show you around the sights of London.
We'll see you in the springtime.
Yeah. Look forward to it.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. I guess February is good for some things, such as stretching your curiosity to discover things you didn't know you really needed to know.
That's nice. That's nicely put.
Right, and a little humor thrown in.
Yeah.
And we encountered that in James Winter's book, Who Put the Beef in Wellington? Who did? We'll talk to him and we'll see.
Hang on, stay with us and you'll find out. Well, maybe you really won't find out, but you'll find out some equally fascinating things like why Melba toast was named and all that kind of good stuff. And a feud between Australia and New Zealand over who invented the pavlova. So it promises to be a very interesting interview. So hang in there with Jim. Jim?
James.
James. Okay, James. I always wanted to know the answer for why Beef Wellington was named after Arthur Wellesley. And we got this book from James Winter, and I thought, the answer's going to be in there. But it's not, you rascal.
I'm sorry. I know. It's a bit of a tease, really. It's one of those never-end, ceaselessly entertaining sort of stories in the food world is the story of the Wellington. And I think, if I can, it's clues in the book. I honestly believe that it was just a bit of English gumption to cook a very French dish for the Duke of Wellington. And I've got a sneaking suspicion they didn't really think about what they were doing until they literally put the thing down and on the table and suddenly thought, what have we done? And they changed its name there and then. That's what I love to believe.
Well, it's if you're Dame Nellie Melba, you're in there twice.
Yes, absolutely. Well, if you're with Dame Nellie Melba, you know, you deserve to be in there twice. She was probably the biggest superstar of her age, and chefs were loving her sort of globe. She was a globetrotter like you two, actually. She was traveling around the globe, enjoying fine dining and having wonderful times, and chefs would love to cook for her. And I guess it was a real honour to make anything for her, but the sort of the peach melba was a piece of beautiful dessert skill from a great chef. But the melba toast, which you're also referring to, was actually something created out of necessity when she was feeling a bit poorly, actually. And so it's got quite a nice romantic story behind that. When she wasn't feeling too well and all she could manage was toast, and they created a whole new kind of toast just for her. That's how famous she was.
I didn't realize how you got to make melba toast so thin. And this book is filled with fascinating things, like you actually half toast a piece of bread, and then you cut it in half, and then however you pronounce it, and then toast it again, and it comes out so light and crunchy that even a sick Dame Nellie Melba can eat it. But that's the whole story of this whole book, isn't it? It's the fascinating stories that you found out when you researched. Now, where did that name come from?
Yes, absolutely, and you know what it's like. You're around the dinner table, stories flow from person to person, and part of the fun of eating and being around the dinner table is these kind of little stories that people find and share with each other. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners and like yourselves are what I call a food geek. I like the geeky stuff in recipes. I like to know not only how to make them and how to prepare them and how to share them, but just something extra about them that brings them to life a little bit, gives them a personality, and often that is a chef behind them, or a celebrity that they're named after, or a battle, or a piece of history, or something that just adds a little bit of character to a plate of food. That's what I love.
Yeah, two of your New Orleans stories, Bananas Foster and Oysters Rockefeller, are good examples. Fill our listeners in on those two guys.
Well, obviously, Oysters Rockefeller is named after Rockefeller. I mean, it's you know, it's one of those dishes that you think probably may have, I mean, it's surprising in a way, but it's come out of New Orleans. You expect it to come out of maybe New York or somewhere like that, but it's one of those moments in food time where a dish was created on for an evening with no real kind of big game plan, and again out of necessity, where certain ingredients were substituted for others, and they had to use a little bit of creativity to create something that people might get excited about in the dining room. And it just turned out that one of the diners declared the dish so rich, it was rich enough for Rockefeller, and that's how the name stuck. It's such a wonderful sort of romantic idea, again, that people would then come back for this one dish, and that's often how restaurants become what they are. One dish can change a chef's life.
Now, Bananas Foster, that's associated with a man whose last name was Foster.
Absolutely, yes, it was. Yeah, no, he was very much a regular diner in the restaurant in New Orleans, and would pop in and come back, and they made it for him. And a lot of the kind of dishes that get remembered for long periods of time, I've found that I've been the ones that have an element of theatre attached to their preparation as well as the presentation. And Bananas Foster was a brilliant bit of tableside culinary sort of creation, which people could not only enjoy eating, but it was a real moment in a dining room. And certainly that style of dining has died away for a number of very boring health and safety star reasons. But I think it's something that at the time was such a big appeal for going out, where you would order a dish purely just to have a man come and cook it at the side of your table, so that all the other diners could see what an exciting time you were having, and prepare it and then enjoy it after that was almost an added bonus. And I think a lot of those dishes come from that style of cooking. And to be honest, I think the modern restaurant scene could benefit quite a lot from bringing a little bit of that showmanship back in.
Now, it's interesting you say that, because Bananas Foster is still fixed that way in many restaurants in New Orleans. But but another dish that used to be equally famous, I mean, you and I, well, I don't know how old you are, but Ann and Peter certainly are old enough to remember a restaurant that used to cook Steak Diane tableside in Pittsburgh. But you say in your book that it died off because tableside dining became too difficult because the spaces were too small.
Yeah, certainly in some of the more heavily populated places around the world. I mean, certainly to be able to serve at the tableside, you need a gap between the tables, which, as you know, in the modern restaurant business, a gap can be a table, can be two people, can be a ticket, can be, you know, income. So those kind of dishes have to make way for other kinds of food that can probably pay a little bit more. So certainly in this country, and certainly in England, and I mean, it's a while since I've never been to Pittsburgh, but certainly sort of across a lot of the cities in New York, I guess that kind of pressure was the same, and those dishes fade away, as well as sometimes before. I've loved the certain dishes. We've had them a lot, and we cook them at home, and the romance of going out to have them again ourselves, having cooked elsewhere, dies away as our culinary skill as a people at home increases.
Yeah, Peter's cousin makes baked Alaska.
My cousin Michael, who's an engineer by training, nevertheless makes baked Alaska. And my Cambridge College dining room, the kitchen could turn out slop for 364 days a year, but on the 365th, they would serve a baked Alaska, which is really wonderful.
Well, that's a wonderful dish to make, because it's got that. It's not only got theatre, but it's got proper chemistry in there. There's real science going on in that dish, which is wonderful. Whether you fully understand what's happening to those egg white molecules or not, it doesn't really matter. But you can see with your eyes that there is something magical happening when you put a ball of ice cream in an oven and it comes out still frozen. It's just pure magic.
Yeah, that's pretty close. Now, I thought it was interesting that the first recipe you chose in the book is Caesar salad.
Yes,
and it wasn't Julius or his brother Augustus, who was my tutor at Cambridge. Just in case you're wondering,
Caesar Cardini, who was running a making a living in the restaurant trade at a very interesting time when people would have to cross that border from America down to Mexico to go looking for booze and fun and kicks and good times, and he made his living and a very good living turning to those people, and those people wanted to drink probably more than they wanted to eat. So he was throwing food together, and, you know, every night with probably very little in thought behind a big menu, and was slowly evolving a kind of a name for the place to be rather than necessarily the place to eat. And this was a salad that people could could eat with her fingers primarily, but also it was quite simple to prepare and was fun and was vibrant and you know, obviously his great name added to that salad menu, but people would talk about it and share it with each other and drive all the way down there to try it.
Now, there's no controversy with that one.
Yeah, two things have happened. First of all, people are dead against anchovies anymore, and the other thing is about the eggs.
Oh, the eggs, yeah.
Yeah, raw eggs. Now
everybody
get after raw eggs.
But I mean,
we certainly did here in Britain, but we're a little bit more lenient about that now. I mean, anchovies are still a sort of a divine ingredient. My wife hates anchovies, so it's one of those dishes that whenever I make it, I have to do some with anchovies, some without the anchovies, and, you know, and it's, you know, whether you put them in or not, it becomes a matter of accuracy.
You can hide them. James, you can hide them. You mash them up and people won't know. It just tastes like umami.
I mean, that's the one, again, talking of magical ingredients, I mean, what better ingredient can be an anchovy, but actually an ingredient that dissolves when you cook it? I mean, that's a magical thing to happen to. Yeah. It just disappears. I mean,
sorrel does that too. Sorrel does that. Did you know that?
Sorrel?
Yeah, it melts.
Okay, well, brilliant. I'll add that to my list of...
disappearing ingredients.
Yeah, I mean, you can make fish sauce because it just totally dissolves. But, you know, the Caesar salad is well documented. A lot of these are well documented. But talk to us about the controversial Reuben sandwich, which is one of my most favorite things.
Yes, now a Reuben sandwich. I mean, how controversial you might find it, but it's another one of those dishes that has a kind of uncertainty about it in terms of how and when it was created, and some people think it was created specifically for one particular diner in Reuben's restaurant in New York, or maybe it was a derivative of an older recipe that he adapted for that particular day for someone. But it's one of those iconic dishes that again gets attached to one particular place in one particular restaurant in one particular city at a particular time. But, you know, as we know, as foodies, as people that go out to eat and dine, can attract lots and lots of interested people to whiz down and try it. And once one person's seen it and tried it, you know that the next person coming in is probably a chef who's looking at it to steal it and share it and put it around to his own clients and sort of spread it around that way. So it's controversial in the sense that no one's exactly certain what its origins are, but it certainly became very popular at a certain diner, probably in sort of the 1930s, in New York, and spread from there. And now, obviously, we all know how to make it, and it's almost iconic in its construction, and it's damn tasty.
Now you tell the story of two countries almost at war over whether or not they invented first the famous Australia or New Zealand dessert called pav or pavlova.
Yeah.
And I never knew that. I only visited New Zealand. I lived for 7 years in Australia. So, of course, I knew that Australia invented it. But in fact, it was a French chef, I think. And I guess he must have just been down under at the time.
I'm just going to say, to be careful, because that's fighting talk. You say Australia created this, in New Zealand you will be in big trouble. And I've got a couple of good friends, chefs from New Zealand, from Australia, who literally, this is one of those subjects that you're a little bit scared to even bring up. People feel so passionately about it. And I don't think they'll ever get to the bottom of which country originated the recipe in the very beginning. It's certainly... You know, different. It could well be a French chef in either of those countries, but the point is, which country was it created in? It seems to be fundamentally important to all Antipodeans.
They have so little else to worry about. I guess that's the reason. Now, Tornado Rossini. That's not hard, I guess. What page are you opening it now?
I'm a little concerned about this salad Olivier. I looked to see because I never understood why one of the standard tapas dishes in Spain is Russian salad, which has nothing to do with Russia whatsoever.
No, I mean it's Russian cuisine is one of those things that's evolved from a whole different set of flavors and ingredients, and a lot of the sort of flavor profiles of their dishes are quite sort of. I suppose, in a way, they're quite sour and sharp and vinegary and for a number of reasons, but probably just to mask a lot of the underlying meat.
Rotten meat.
Was, yeah, was underneath it at the time, and that's built in the profile of the number of dishes which you associate strongly with a lot of Eastern European cuisine, which now, as we're all sort of globally gastronomic, we learn to appreciate and like for different reasons, and obviously serve it with better quality ingredients, and that's how it's kind of, yeah, I mean, it's one of those that you can hide a number of things under the sauce. I think that's why it's so popular with chefs.
I like your description of the reason why beef stroganoff is cooked so carefully and well. It's because Count Stroganoff couldn't chew very well later in life. So his kitchen.
Yes, apparently dental hygiene was something to be feared.
Yeah. Well, what's next, James Winter?
For me, I'm a television producer by trade, so. I mean, I produce a live weekly food, cooking show for BBC One here every weekend, actually. So, next, tomorrow morning, I'll be up at 5:30 in the morning here to go and do some live broadcasting.
What's on the program tomorrow?
We've got, well, the show that it's purely presented by a brilliant chef called James Martin, who I don't know, or you may or may not have come across in your travels. And he's joined every week by a couple of restaurant chefs. So we're doing, we've got a lovely Italian, well, he's not Italian, but he cooks wonderful Italian food, a man named Theo Randall, who's on the program.
Oh, sure. His name's familiar.
Yeah, he's cooking some tagliarini, lovely. I mean, Theo's food is so perfect for television, to be honest, because it's all raw ingredients to cooked ingredients in about 5 minutes with very little, apart from just, you know, wonderful passion. And then a brilliant new chef, we've not had on the show before, who cooks at Jamie Oliver's restaurant in London called 15, which is the first restaurant with Jamie Oliver, which is run by a group of apprentices, which every year they spend a year in the kitchen with various chefs, but at the moment it's a chef called John Rotherham. So he's cooking a lovely, I mean, James, the 15 restaurant has changed in its food offering quite a bit since it first opened, and now it's in a modern British phase, and John is one of those wonderful new breed of chefs that takes British ingredients and puts them at the centre of quite international dishes. So he's doing effectively a kind of version of a steamed bun, but with with beef instead of pork, and a lovely horseradish cream and some pickled walnuts.
Oh, you're making us hungry. You're making us hungry.
Well, that's what we do. Yeah, wonderful. Because that's what we try and do to our viewers. We just try and make them hungry and inspire them a little bit. So, you know, in between that, we play lots of bits of other people's food shows. We'd always play films from Rick Stein, and we follow a series. Well, you have MasterChef in America.
It's
popular here, obviously. So we play little segments of MasterChef for people to enjoy and follow the story. And various other people like Raymond Blanc and stuff. We have little films from them.
I have Raymond Blanc stories. We're not going to repeat that.
And don't go there. But anyway, here's a new recipe for you to include in book two of Who Put the Best in Beef in Wellington. It's called Who Put the Lentils in Boiled Eggs? and they're called Eggs Anna, just in case you're having trouble figuring it out.
Oh, we're getting giddy now, James. We're going to have to say goodbye.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us today. And
it's been lovely talking to you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you.
We'll catch up with you across the big pond one of these days.
Oh, definitely. Yes, look me up.
And don't go away, because we will be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, we're back. We're back, and it's quiz time. What river flows, it seems like, almost the opposite way to what it should, because it flows through Stratford-upon-Avon, celebrated, of course, for its association with Shakespeare, and then heads in a westward direction for reasons known only to itself, and then enters the Bristol Channel at the city of Bristol, the River Avon, and right beside the River Avon, at a place now called River Station, is what used to be the Water Police Barracks.
It's a
great location, an absolutely charming spot, and we had the chance to talk to a chef who is, well, you won't be surprised, I guess, to find out how he got to Bristol, but you will wonder until you have the answer. And we also had a chance to meet the owner, Peter Taylor, but he was busy because it was 2 days before Christmas. And as usual, when we go to Bristol, it was pouring down with rain.
Yeah, we keep trying to see Bristol, well, you know, but it keeps raining.
But we keep finding great places to eat. So, anyhow,
we did talk to Toru Yanada, and he seems to be having a pretty splendid time.
I should apologize in advance because the room where we recorded this interview, it turned out to be something of an echo chamber. Bear with us, and if you can't stand it, just fast forward and about 10 minutes and we'll pick up where we left off.
We seem to have a knack for finding Japanese chefs in unusual places. Now, it's a long way from Tokyo to Bristol. We're talking to Chef Toru Yanada, who has taken over the kitchen with the other owner chef, Peter Taylor, working on the menu at River Station in Bristol. Toru, the idea that you really began being interested in being a chef at the early age of 17. That's actually pretty late compared to most chefs. Did you cook before then?
I guess I did. I cooked up to when I was 14, and really become a professional chef probably since 17. But before that, kind of had a hobby during my life. I all lived with my life.
Why Bristol? It just seems a little out of the way for a Japanese trained chef to come all the way to England and land in Bristol. What brings you here?
I married for the English. Got my qualification. So then I'm playing in French and Italian chef anyway. I'm really, to be honest, I've never been trained by Japanese chef. So I always kind of trained by those people. And really my specialty is kind of Western European food really. That one is Japanese. But still, put together my Japanese influence of my nature and European my techniques together. So my answer, the big answer to the question is yes, because my wife is English. And I mean, sometimes we have stayed for a long time in the countryside, Shropshire, but I want somewhere a little more city where I'm comfortable and the city feeling. I'm a London is too busy. So what I'm doing is that this way of both fun in the city, nice and chill out, and after a lot of food.
Now, one of the things that makes this restaurant so special is its location on the river. I'm terrible geography. What river are we on? And it's talk about this, how this river experience enhances your restaurant.
Can you do that again?
You didn't quite understand what you said.
Let's talk about the location on the river and how that adds and makes this experience of the restaurant special.
Experience with riverside is for both a customer, for the interest, and nice kind of feeling rather than just enjoying food. And probably I imagine kind of goes really poorly by the water from the evening. And also for the chef and the whole waiter, the manager and the whole work up here, it will make us really happy. Rather than just sitting inside somewhere else, city, random place and by the water, why are we here? Water there, then can sort of subconsciously make us really nice and relaxed and make us happy. And I believe it to customer as well.
And the name of the river is
Avon.
Avon.
Yeah, A-V-O.
Like in Stratford.
Well, I should know that. That's a very famous river. And I do believe that you're right, a happy kitchen makes for a happy meal. Now, you say you're European trained more and influenced, but also you do have your Japanese influences, and you seem to be adding a little bit of that into your dishes. I had, for example, a scallop dish today. Explain that to our listeners. What's in it?
It's, that's a well-realized Japanese influence dish in the whole menu for today. Just rather than using scallops and pasta, you can pick up that, which is a old Japanese style of sushi. Even sushi, so people think that sushi is raw fish or really white or whatever. But proper Japanese and old style sushi is quite often marinade or broadloaded or do something with it. And put it right, which is slightly different with just raw fish and meat, raw fish and dry fish over here. So the time using that kind of small technique, Japanese technique into it, and bring it to the little European style to it, that's what I'm doing at the moment.
How about some other influences? I think you're very much taken with product. You have the place names where you get all the local products. You like, you live in Cornwall, right? And so you have Cornish ingredients.
Yes, actually I never lived in Cornwall, but I kind of like reading relationships with Cornish supplier and then Cornish couple supplier. One of the probably most useful suppliers for green fish. It's a really good supplying a lot of global salt for the hake today.
Hake,
And actually place as well, we do get from them quite a lot. And they are really fresh, and they never let it down. For example, if they really came here, yes, if people make a mistake from them, they can get it, and I order it, but it's not that good enough, they don't send it. I just, instead of sending it, I'm just phoning the process. I can't send it to them, not good enough. They kind of don't really have a relationship with them, so I'm using a quite formal fish quite a lot. And also for the local supplier as well, I'm coming up with some user from Devonshire clients for, and also a lot of states we send in for once in a time to a company our local butcher in the Bath, local butcher for Bath. It's a very good relationship as well. All the time for make sure at least 28 days coming. It's good for everything, and for environment, good for environment, and good for relations with players as well. And I agree with you, more important for customers.
Now, everyone seems to be very interested in your desserts. Do you have a great deal of affinity for sweets? Because you have some really striking desserts on this menu, and you serve big quantities of sweets.
Yeah, I do like sweets. Personally as well, probably compared to most chefs, I can do quite a lot of desserts, and surprisingly, I have seen a lot of chefs, it's quite good at table, but kind of can't really have time to get on the street. I do have a really good pastry chef, in the kitchen. I don't hardly do pastry chef that much by physically, but we always he's working here for 8 years now, so we can have quite a good relationship, and his mind is going to come in, and he can make a good communication with
me. How much involvement do you have in the wine program? Peter was very impressed with your for a small restaurant, you have a very interesting lineup.
Yes, people to, I don't know about wine that much of people. Especially, what I learned about wine in Japan, which is a princess from, basically. So my wine, which is to be honest, the main different wine. And, so I know how, what sort of wine goes with what certain kind of food. I kind of got it kind of in my head. But, I don't know what sort of wine is similar, what sort of wine is kind of same land, that kind of thing. But people really help us, really a lot out there. I think it's, last month, no, last year, we, this, we won, best wine, restaurant.
Which is,
yes, in Brisbane, which is, he's kind of told me, he kind of made me a wine list. From scratch. But we are really, really lucky to have him around for one week and doing one bit for us.
Do you find that the customers, diners, in, first of all, let's talk about English in general, English diners, and secondly, Bristol. Is there a specific market of people who are different as diners than, say, you know, London, further north, or further south?
Yeah, I found a, because I don't know about London that much, but when I talk to people, then I got some kind of from London, a lot of ships, I think the, in the British people, the, as customers, they are looking for something different, as well as compared to, let's say, Shropshire, and, kind of more like an open, in a way.
Yeah.
I think that compared to London, yeah, probably, like I said before, a little more chill out, but, kind of relax and start the sort of prepare that, which is, I really understand and that probably suits me as well. I used to work in quite a few mission stores as well, but after using that skill and the experience, I want to be a little more relaxed kind of food as well. So probably that case on what I'm trying to do and what they kind of look for. Pretty similar at the moment anyway, I'm heard and you know that personally. I hope that's correctly.
Well, I think it's a charming experience coming here. The people seem to be really having a glorious time. Lots of families gathered. Of course, it is a Sunday. Parties. I think that, it's because it's casual, relaxed, with a nice setting, and good kitchen. Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for coming today, and I hope you done okay. And I hope you enjoy your lesson. Thank you very much.
Arigato.
Arigato. どういたしまして.
And we're going to a break, but don't go away because everybody loves grilled cheese, and you're going to be able to find out how to make it in some very special ways right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Shane Kearns has written a book called Melt, 100 Amazing Adventures in Grilled Cheese. Before we start, I might tell you that Shane dearly adored grilled cheese sandwiches, and when I went off to college, the dorm food was so dreadful that I would, even though my meal plan was paid for, I would sneak across the street and eat grilled cheese. And I like it with tomatoes, actually, too. And then I gained 15 pounds.
Okay. That was a bad meal plan.
It was not good.
So the grilled cheese diet is not...
It's not working.
It's not a diet. It's an anti-diet.
Yes.
Exactly. everything in moderation, I guess.
Now, Shane, you have a story to tell about how you came to write this book. And obviously, most people in the world love grilled cheese sandwiches, but you have a very particular story. Tell us about your blog and your training and so forth.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for having me on. But, yeah, the kind of stumbled into the book, so to speak. So I did go to the University of Cincinnati for digital design and studied there. And then when I graduated, I did have a little trouble finding a digital design job. This was back some recession, beginning of it or whatnot. But I eventually found one, and it was a day job, 9-to-5 digital design. I worked for a trade publication that did music magazines and whatnot, and I was their web guy, handled the websites, emails, and everything like that. And I wanted to do something that also outside of work where I could use my creativity and photography that I enjoyed. So I decided to start grilledchain.com. At the time it had a different name. But I started the blog, and once a week on Sundays, I would cook grilled cheese sandwiches, push the envelope. People typically think of a grilled cheese sandwich, American cheese and white bread. I tried to push that a little further, push the envelope. I've always enjoyed grilled cheese. My mother, my grandmother always made it for me. Everyone loves it these days. Come a big thing and whatnot. So from there, I started the blog, and I would cook a grilled cheese sandwich about once a week and stuff like that. So I started the blog to push the envelope, my creativity a little bit, do some photography work. I did all the photography in the book.
Oh, I was going to ask you that.
They're good photos. Thank you. I did most of the photos in the book. So once I had the day job, I was doing the digital design stuff. And before I got that job, I was working in the restaurant just like temporary until I found that design job. And then I still worked there on the weekends. So I kind of had two jobs going. Working 5 days a week as digital designer, and then on Saturdays work at the restaurant. Eventually I realized I liked the restaurant better, so I left the digital design job, did the restaurant full time, and then I think while I was working there, I believe, is when the publisher emailed me and said, "We're thinking of doing a grilled cheese book, would you like to do it?" And I was like, "Yes, sure, please, how do I sign up?" and everything like that. So it was never, I don't know that I ever had the intention of doing a book, until the publisher wrote me and said, "Do you want to do a book?" I said, "Of course, yes." So, I mean, we went back and forth, did all that stuff, and the paperwork and whatnot, and that's how the book came to be. So it was built out of the blog of me doing a grilled cheese. I tried to do it on Sunday nights when I wasn't working and it was quiet and stuff. I just cook a grilled cheese, come up with some ideas, and then throw the photos in a grade up on the website, see what people thought.
I think people might be a little bit surprised at some of these recipes. I certainly was. Fried matzo with horseradish mayo.
Yeah, there's a little bit of something for everybody. The publisher said 50 sweet and 50 savory, and that I could only use up to about 15 from the blog. I'm not sure the exact number that I did use from the blog, but so a lot of those are originals based just for the book, and it was tough. You gotta think of just random different ingredients and go from there and start building a grilled cheese sandwich from it. But yeah, I mean, there's some that some people might not consider a grilled cheese, but they're fun and they taste good, so that's all that matters.
Yeah, I mean, change up the cheese, the bread, the filling, should we call it, even the overall form of it as maybe a non-sandwich.
There's some, like with bread, there's some on mushrooms and I believe lettuce, the dessert ones. Very few of them even use bread. They use cookies or brownies and stuff like that. So I guess
we just got a whole box of Hershey's products. I'm wondering, can we make a Hershey cheese sandwich?
Oh, of course. There's some good desserts, cheeses like mascarpone and stuff like that. You can even mix chocolate. I've done that. Mix chocolate into the cheese, and you've got yourself a chocolate cheese kind of filling and stuff. So you could put that on just about anything, and it would be delicious.
And in her dorm room in Ann Arbor would not be short of new ideas.
Not at all.
So you have two parts. The first is the savory, as you said, and the second, many, many surprises, such as sea salt caramel. That, to me, is a far remove from grilled cheese sandwiches.
Yeah, I tried to push the envelope a little bit. The publisher wanted something fun. They wanted the 50 dessert ones. Before I even did the book, I'd only done one or two dessert ones on the blog because I hadn't really messed around with it or played with it that much. But once they said, "We need the 50 sweet, the 50 savory," I'm like, "Oh, good. Now I get to play with the sweet because it's something different I hadn't done." And I mean, with the dessert, there's a lot of cheeses out there specifically that you can use for dessert sandwiches, and you can push the envelope. And like you said, they may not be grilled cheese sandwiches, but as long as they taste good and are and you can enjoy them for dessert after a nice meal or something. I say,
yeah, I mean, sometimes you use cookies for the bread.
Yeah, that was the one with the cookie. I think it was the cookie cheesecake one. Is yeah, one of my favorites.
Yeah, they're both good. Boston cream pie?
Yeah. Got to take inspiration from anywhere you can
get
it.
Apple pie. The mini eggplant sliders seemed like a fairly obvious one to do.
Yeah, that one was pretty good.
What's your favorite of all these?
The cookie cheesecake's got to be the dessert one is my favorite. I'm a guy who likes richness, and that definitely had a lot of rich flavors and textures. And my father, who helped taste test some of these, it was even a little too rich for him, but I enjoyed that thoroughly. But on, like, the savory side, there's one, oddly enough, with popcorn in there.
Oh, I enjoyed. I haven't seen that one. Which one's that?
I don't remember the exact name of, but there's one with popcorn, and then there's one even with the mashed potatoes, which I really...
You know, here's one with risotto.
Yeah. There's some with a little bit of carb overloads and...
How about ramen?
Bad carbs, but they're still pretty good.
And did you steal some of these ideas from the mashups of burgers?
I don't know if my inspiration ever came. I might have thought of it here and there from hamburgers and stuff, because it's kind of a similar idea, because you can do a lot with hamburgers and throw different cheeses and different fillings on it. But I kind of, my inspiration kind of came from just walking through the grocery store and looking at the different ingredients and going home and seeing what I could make from that, like different ingredients I might not have used before or anything like that. I would walk through like Whole Foods, or you could walk through any grocery store, start looking, writing down ideas, put them in your phone or whatever, and just see what ingredients you haven't used or you want to use and you want to experiment with, and just go from there. My mom was actually at the fast food place Steak and Shake, and she thought of, she saw baked beans on there, so she came home and said, "What about an idea with baked beans?" I said, "Sure." So there's a pretzel baked beans one in there that we got inspired randomly enough from Steak and Shake. So whatever you have in your pantry or whatever you want to mess around with at the grocery store, you can make it into a grilled cheese, and it would most likely be very good.
What are some of the exotic cheeses? I mean, I'm sure you've explored exotic cheeses. You must spend quite a lot of time in front of the cheese aisle at Whole Foods.
Yeah, I spend a lot, and I mean, there are so many cheeses that I haven't even touched. I tried with the book. There aren't extremely, extremely exotic cheeses, because I wanted this, at least this book, to be one that people can basically pick up off the shelf. They don't have to run to their local exotic cheese store to get it. They could go to the grocery store or anything like that and wouldn't have any problems. But some of the more exotic ones are like Work, which is a creamier cheese that's more of a dessert cheese, or Manchego. There's Kerrygold that make a lot of nice cheeses that I like. There's even this raclette cheese, which I use in one of it, that they have.
We have a special
kit that you use to melt the cheese and everything. So,
I mean, love that raclette, really.
Yeah, it's really cool. Raclette is a really cool cheese, so that's fun to mess with. There's just so many cheeses, and I don't feel like I've hit even like a tenth of all the cheeses out there, but there's so many. Just to walk in front of the cheese department at any grocery store.
Did you include a Reuben?
There's actually a different Reuben. There, I think I did a fish Reuben. I forget.
Oh.
Yeah, instead of the corned beef or whatnot, I did fish to switch it up a little bit. I tried to, like, there's the wedge salad with the blue cheese and the iceberg. I made that into a sandwich because my dad likes that. So I tried to...
The whole family got involved, I guess. Huh?
Yeah, mom was a huge help. I mean, when I had to make actually do the recipes, and because I tasted them, I photographed them all and everything. Once I got all set with the paperwork and stuff, they had said it was all finished probably January, February, and they said the book was coming out in the holiday season. So I'm like, oh, I got plenty of time to make the sandwiches, take the photographs, think of them. But they wanted my everything done, manuscript, by like March or something, and this was January, February-ish. So I was making 6 to 12 sandwiches a day, photographing them all, tasting them all, and then next day we'd move on to something else. So,
now, how many pounds did you put on?
Thankfully, I didn't put on too many pounds. I would only, as much as I'd want to eat a whole sandwich, I basically took a couple bites, make sure that it tasted good, I was good with the flavor or whatnot, and didn't have to remake it. So then I just went from there. So thankfully, if I ate all of them, I probably would have put on about 10 to 15 pounds. But once they were made, I tried them. They were good. Moved on to the next one. Some of my favorite ones I would eat more than a couple bites. But
this is quite a singular achievement for a digital design guy.
I've always liked to cook, and I've always been interested in it. My mom's always cooked, and and stuff like that. So it kind of is an extension of that, and then the photography and the web design kind of played into the blog. So it's a little bit different from digital design cooking random grilled cheese sandwiches, but it kind of goes.
Now, if you're listeners, if you're into this, if you have ideas to contribute, if you have questions, the great part about it is that Shane has a blog. Your blog is?
GrilledShane.com.
So contribute your ideas, make your suggestions, add to the book. There's probably a book two behind this somewhere, I'm sure.
I would love to do a book two. I would love to.
And just because you're from Cincinnati doesn't mean we don't like you a whole lot.
Well, I went to school in Cincinnati, but I live in Cleveland now. So.
Oh, well
that's even worse.
Not making it any better for myself.
No, but never mind. Steeler fans like grilled cheese too.
And, yes, they do.
So the Steeler Nation and the OTM worldwide audience are all grateful to you for your contribution, and we wish you well, and more grilled cheesing.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
So, with a grilled cheese sandwich before you go to bed, or whatever you like before you go to bed, or whatever you're going to do for the rest of the day, have fun with it. We hope you'll join us again. Same time, same place next week, and until then,
bye-bye.